Meeting of Parliament, Friday the 23rd of July 2021. We continue with the debate on the Appropriation Bill.
The Honourable Marlene Hassan Naon.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. Mr. Speaker, I would like to start today by expressing just how grateful I am to the outgoing clerk of the House, Mr. Paul Martinez, on the eve of his retirement, for his years of service in this place, and particularly for always being there for me. Mr. Speaker, in my solitary position in this House, it isn't always easy to know exactly how things go or how things should be done. And Paul has always been a solid steer to me, someone who I could always count on for advice, for direction, and for mentorship. And so for my part, Mr. Speaker, he will be sorely missed, and whoever takes on his position will have very big shoes to fill. I do take this opportunity to wish him a very happy and well-deserved retirement. And I would also like to take this opportunity to thank him once again and the referendum team from Parliament and ITLD for their sterling work during the recent referendum and the previous same referendum barely a year before, which was postponed at the last minute due to COVID. Two referendums in the space of a year, Mr. Speaker, as well as two election campaigns, the Brexit referendum, two European elections, and so much more, Mr. Speaker. Paul has always been there for all of us, and for that, I thank him again, and the Parliament team, Kevin, Danny, Simon, Daniel, and of course, your good self, Mr. Speaker. I would also like to thank our media, our national broadcaster, GBC, for diligently and consistently reporting on the COVID crisis as it unfolded and ensuring that this community was regularly informed and updated despite all the challenges that meant for every individual and their families while members of the media braved this unknown pandemic from the front line to give us visibility and information throughout the lockdown and beyond. Of course, similarly, Mr. Speaker, we are also indebted eternally to our nurses, our doctors, our healthcare workers who risked their own lives and that of their families to be there for hours during the pandemic. And the same goes for all law enforcement and essential services, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. And despite the policy differences between myself and the members opposite, on a one-to-one level, Mr. Speaker, I would like to extend my thanks to the Honourable members Samantha Sacramento, John Cortes, for always being available to assist with the representations I bring to them from my constituents. And the same goes for the Honourable Vijay Dayanani, my good friend, who despite comments from this side of the House, works so hard, and in my view, Mr. Speaker, really does not deserve to bear the brunt of much of what he gets because of cancellations and closures from entities associated with his portfolio, which are happening because of the times we live in, Mr. Speaker, and not because of his approach or his efforts. I find this quite ungenerous most of the time, infantile and unnecessary, and waste parliamentary and people's time, Mr. Speaker. I also wish to thank the Deputy Chief Minister and the Chief Minister himself for being ready to discuss issues pertaining to constituents who reach out to me and require help. On a day-to-day, Mr. Speaker, these members opposite are always ready to assist me when I give them a shout, and for that, I am very grateful. And the same goes for Mrs. Denise Guillot, Number 6, who the Chief Minister has often delegated my constituent cases to help out with and never fails to listen and help me wherever she can when I am referred to her. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, turning to the budget now. The budget speech will be remembered by all of us for years to come. It will go down in history as the first budget after the COVID pandemic and after 2 years of fear, isolation, and uncertainty. In some ways, it will be the budget of hope, not because of its content, Mr. Speaker, which is worrying for the future of our community, but because it marks another step in our return to normality. A normality that I am optimistic will come if we are patient act responsibly, and let science lead the way. Unfortunately, this budget will also be known as the moment of reckoning for the GSOP administration of the Chief Minister, the Honourable Mr. Fabian Picardo. The Honourable Leader of the Opposition referred to it as a budget without hope. The Honourable Mr. Roy Clinton called it a beggar's bowl budget. And the Chief Minister himself, much in his hyperbolic style, coined the catchphrase, the hardest budget in history. To me, Mr. Speaker, this is yet another budget of anger and frustration, another facade of a budget script with the latest performance of a very gifted actor in a second-rate play. A budget fiction novel with clever prose, but a completely unbelievable plot. To me, this is the budget of decay, and I will explain what I mean in due course. Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar has had enormous competitive advantages for a long, long time. What Mr. Picardo described as the goose that laid the golden egg, but its leaders have not had the foresight to use the wealth generated by industries that were doomed to veer away from these industries into more robust, sustainable, and forward-looking ones that would guarantee our long-term prosperity. They did not have the foresight either, despite what you might have heard from members opposite, to spend prudently and responsibly in anticipation of a rainy day that was always going to come sooner or later. And they were warned, Mr. Speaker, by me particularly, but also by other members of this House. My party, Together Gibraltar, and I have said many times that Gibraltar needs profound structural changes, that it had to be weaned off the tobacco trade, some of which, Mr. Speaker, tolerated illicit trade, that it had to move away from fossil fuel bunkering, that it had to move away from fiscal dumping and opaque finances, because sooner or later it was clear that these industries would come into direct conflict with an evolving world. A world in which public coffers cannot afford any more tax avoidance, where the planet cannot take any more carbon pollution, and where tobacco and other unhealthy demons are being slowly exorcised from our lives. And these are not the only changes, Mr. Speaker. As noted by many of my fellow MPs on both sides of the House, many global paradigms have changed in these 2 years. We have lost friends and family members. We have tasted isolation and withdrawal. We have become much more in touch with our fear and our vulnerability. And we have been reminded of the importance of the institutions that represent the common good. Throughout the COVID pandemic, the daily briefings at Number 6 provided us with much needed calm and reassurance. We also followed other global leaders and the struggle of other nations, applauded our public healthcare workers, and many of us, not all, Mr. Speaker, but many, felt the financial support of the state when we needed it most. This pandemic has reminded us of the value of the state as the only instrument capable of navigating profound crises, and in the midst of these, be the custodians of order and the protectors of the greater good. It is from this perspective that it becomes particularly tragic to analyze the obliteration of our country's public finances at the hands of this administration, in a world threatened by climate change and the many challenges of globalization. What will happen next time we need a helping hand from the state? Can we promise our children that they will be protected from chaos if they have the misfortune that we have had these past years? We certainly cannot, Mr. Speaker. In fact, as raised by the Honourable Mr. Roy Clinton to my right, this government cannot even tell us how it intends to face its debt commitments for the next 3 years, let alone beyond. This redefinition of the role of the state into a more interventionist, paternalistic entity, ready to step in with great might when things get tough, has to also bring a redefinition of the role of private enterprise and capital. What we cannot continue to have, Mr. Speaker, is the kind of breach of the social contract of the 2008 financial crisis brought in which decades of neoliberal policies, low taxation, and financial malpractice gave way to public bailouts for the banks and led to austerity for the people. The damage this political response had on people's faith in the system was truly devastating, and the consequences of this can still be felt today. It is my belief and that of my party that if we respond to the needs of our badly wounded public finances in a way that is unfair or that does not make the most fortunate pay their fair share of the cost of recovery, we will also be partaking in the weakening of our democracy and our institutions. If we now apply austerity to those who need it the most, we will destroy what is left of the social fabric of the people of Gibraltar, a close-knit fabric that has been the key to the resilience of our people. As a side note, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to share a very personal experience. Through the COVID pandemic, I was forced to spend time away from my aging mother, as so many people were, due to fear of contagion. She suffers from dementia, and at the time, her condition was not great, but she was still there. There were still sparks of her feisty, powerful former self. After the lockdown was over and the vaccines were delivered, I was allowed to spend time with her again, but something had changed. The isolation had caused a sharper decline than we thought was possible. This has made me realize the suffering of those who experience loneliness and involuntary solitude, an ongoing pandemic that plagues many elderly members of our community, even when social distance is not forced upon us. Let this be a gentle reminder, Mr. Speaker, that we have to find a way to tackle this as a community. Visit the elderly, spend time with them, care for them, love and care, soothe and heal. Because, Mr. Speaker, isolation and loneliness kills. On this note, I would like to start my analysis by giving you my take on the COVID response of this government, although it may be fairer to say that this response was a cross-party affair between the GSOP and the GSD. Their presence in every discussion and briefing surely a testament to the official opposition's endorsement of said response, Mr. Speaker. When the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, says that there was unity in the response, I guess he makes the same mistake that him and so many others in this chamber make all too often. He forgets that this is not just a boys' game, Mr. Speaker, and that there is another significant presence in this Parliament. I'm talking about, of course, the presence of this Honourable Lady, the woman that doesn't understand politics, the woman that doesn't write her own speeches, the woman that has these crazy views. Because I get all of this in this House, Mr. Speaker, the full spectrum of male chauvinism, the mansplaining, the patronizing, and the gaslighting to boot. And little Malene Hassan and her party cannot be taken seriously despite having a few fair votes, more than other honourable members who do get to sit at the table with the big boys. There was no unity in the COVID response, Mr. Speaker, because I and Together Gibraltar were left out of the discussions of the COVID response team. And why, Mr. Speaker? Because I had the audacity to point out that our then health minister had been posting wanderlust pictures in Tarifa while we were all scared to death and trying to get people to adhere to public health advice urgently. For this, I was insulted and later marginalized from doing my job as a leader of a party with over 20% of the votes at the last election. Unfortunately for government, we used this episode to reclaim our place as the only independent, free-thinking voice at a time in which there were none and health policy had to be taken to task. We constantly advocated for a more prudent management of the pandemic from a public health point of view. We advocated for greater mask use and harsher enforcement of healthcare protocols. We called out the lack of example of Mr. Picardo and some of his ministers who went around hospitals getting photos taken of themselves unmasked with big groups of people. We put pressure on more and faster testing. We called out the leniency of government regarding Christmas celebrations, and particularly we criticized the government-endorsed culture of recklessness that seemed to take over Gibraltar after the miraculously benign first wave. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, what came after the Christmas gomelonas is one of the darkest chapters of our history, if not the darkest. 94 lives lost, a total number of over 4,600 cases. A proportion of cases and deaths in our elderly residential services that far outnumbers even the countries worst hit by the pandemic. Double the deaths per capita of La Linea or Algeciras. Almost three times the number of deaths per capita than the province of Andalusia. We cannot participate in the self-congratulatory fanfare over the pandemic response from a public health policy point of view, Mr. Speaker. We could have done better. Lives could have been saved with a more cautious and coherent approach. We believe that an inquiry into the handling of the second COVID wave in the ERS is absolutely necessary, and we hope it will allow us to understand what exactly happened and, if necessary, assign culpability. This is the only way to learn from our mistakes, Mr. Speaker, however painful and traumatic this episode may be. What we can say, and we do so with great pride, Mr. Speaker, despite the also massive numbers of cases we've had in our community, which were, in our opinion, exacerbated by the culture of recklessness and the incoherence of government messaging. I mean, does anybody remember the press conference in which we were treated to a long list of Star Wars puns and jokes? Was that just me, Mr. Speaker, or was it plain disrespectful at that time? We do say with great pride that our healthcare professionals fared very well in comparison to other European counterparts and did a heroic and outstanding job, saving many lives and helping our community through these terrifying and extraordinarily hard times. I think that it would be an apt homage to them and the lives lost to COVID if we may agree on a date in the calendar year and created our own National Public Health Day in which we could all go out to the balconies to clap and give thanks to our healthcare professionals, as well as remember our loved ones lost to the pandemic. And remember, Mr. Speaker, the pandemic is not over. Just as we did back then, I say to the people of Gibraltar now, exercise great caution. Use masks indoors when you can, outside of social bubbles. Wash your hands. Avoid large crowds. The number of cases is growing again at an alarming rate, and so is, albeit slowly, the number of hospitalizations. Let's do our bit to curb the spread and thus the mutation of the virus. We are over the worst of the pandemic, but we still need a last push to see it through. Let's give this last push together, Mr. Speaker, in real unity. Now I will concentrate on the economy, Mr. Speaker, and the issues pertaining to the letter, or should I say the number, of this budget. The budget of decay is, as I mentioned earlier, begins with a remarkable story of unprecedented success and unparalleled governance that has finally delivered the elusive socialist utopia. Of course, little, if anything at all, of that narrative is true. I will therefore try to establish some differences between what life looks like on planet Picardo and what it looks like here on Earth for us mere mortals. In planet Picardo, we are the spoiled child of Europe. We have got it better than ever before. In fact, we have had it too well. Viviendo por encima de nuestras posibilidades, as Rajoy's PP government used to say across the frontier. The chief minister is telling us, you are so lucky, don't complain. Your lives could not possibly be better. You are richer than the Germans, and being better and richer than the Germans always sounds very impressive, Mr. Speaker. But in the real world, things are pretty different. Perhaps here it would be the fair thing to do to differentiate between the two castes in Gibraltar, particularly when referring to the lower end of the earning spectrum, private sector workers and civil servants, with the latter enjoying very generous conditions and the former suffering from pretty dire ones. In the real world, statistics of average earnings are, like the Honourable Mr. Clinton said, completely meaningless. They are distorted by high earners, which amount to a disproportionate number of people due to our economic model so generous with the wealthy. Our pensions are squalid, our unemployment benefits practically non-existent, statutory protections in the private sector are crippling, parental leave and pay are laughable. Too many of our citizens live in housing squalor, unable to enter a completely manic property ladder while wasting away in a never-ending housing list. There is a lot of substandard housing in both the public and private markets, and inside them dwell the most unfortunate and needy of our people. None of that matters, Mr. Speaker, because you are spoilt. And therefore I ask myself, Mr. Speaker, who spoilt us? Is it the fault of the child that he or she has been spoilt, or is it the fault of the parents who are responsible for the child's education? The culture of entitlement has not emerged spontaneously from within, Mr. Speaker. Surely the people responsible for the culture of entitlement are those that have been promising more and more to our people in successive manifestos. Also, it has to be said, Mr. Speaker, unless we believe that the culture of entitlement only started 10 years ago and is a decade old, surely the GSD has also had a part to play in the establishment of such a culture. We have said it before, and we say it again now. To suggest that the problem is a culture of entitlement is to avoid responsibility and engage in an exercise of victim blaming. The problem is not a culture of entitlement, but a culture of irresponsible governance and reckless political campaigning, of giving people freebies and raises before election day in order to get re-elected, of sending letters promising everything to every single person and organization before they win, of trying to outpromise each other party in every election. In our first and only election, Mr. Speaker, Together Gibraltar was coherent with this. We presented a modest and costed manifesto that promised to bring an end to any capital projects that did not meet urgent housing demands. We were prudent and promised more in the way of changes of governance and culture than tangible costly assets. Our policy pillars were equality, environmental protection, and the fight against corruption. And our star policies were bicycle lanes, better parental leave provisions, and more independent scrutiny of public spending. No, Mr. Speaker, we are not responsible for the culture, and neither is the general public. Our leaders are, past and present, and to have the cheek to point their fingers at the people of Gibraltar and scold them for it is outrageous, Mr. Speaker, simply outrageous. On the issue of debt, we are also a million miles away from Planet Bigardo. This budget shows a contraction of our economy of 4.9%, less than half of that of the worst hit economies in Europe. We have racked up a £158 million deficit between spending and loss of revenue, and 50 million more is predicted from now to, according to predictions, till the financial year's end. However, according to the Chief Minister, after achieving record-breaking economic results year after year for a decade, our net debt now stands at some £720 million. In the real world, Mr. Speaker, nobody believes this narrative anymore. In fact, the Chief Minister doesn't believe it himself. He said it clearly in his speech. that if he hadn't hidden away debt in the Gibraltar government-owned companies, he would have had to report to Parliament and ask for the modification of the debt ceiling. He is congratulating himself for avoiding parliamentary scrutiny, Mr. Speaker, admitting that indirect borrowing hidden in government-owned companies is, in fact, government borrowing, and admitting that the level of debt is higher than it is made out to be in his books. A triple admission of guilt, Mr. Speaker, in one fell swoop, in one act of trademark Picardo Blaster, por la boca muere el pez, Mr. Speaker, especially when the fish is overconfident and out of touch. In Planet Picardo, the fact that the UK provided support for our borrowing with a 500 million sovereign fund guarantee shows the resilience of our finances. What kind of nonsense is this, Mr. Speaker? So the fact that now we need someone to back our borrowing to keep interest low means our economy is robust? In the real world, when one needs securities for their borrowing, it is because they don't have the best credit rating. The UK have helped us in a time of need, and Boris Johnson has lived up to his promise, reiterated time and time again that the UK would stand by Gibraltar as a member of its family. Also, in the real world, jurisdictions that do not have their own currency and therefore no monetary policy require the kind of help the UK very kindly offered us. It was a display of solidarity and support from the UK, no doubt, but an endorsement of the state of our public finances, it was not, Mr. Speaker. Also, in the real world, and as explained thoroughly and with great detail by my opposition colleague, the Honourable Roy Clinton, there is close to £1 billion of what should be net debt hidden in government-owned companies. £1 billion. That makes a grand total of £1.7 billion of net debt, triple the sum Mr. Picardo promised to have 51,000 for every man, woman, and children of Gibraltar. That is the true figure of our public debt, and it is high time they recognized it. In Planet Picardo, the COVID pandemic has been worse than the closure of the frontier and the MOD dockyard together. It has been a seismic event, a meteor that has decimated our otherwise robust and healthy economy. In the real world, however, of the £1.7 billion of debt, only some £250 million can be attributed to COVID, which amounts to approximately 15% of the total gross debt. The government are clearly trying to sweep a decade of systemic economic mismanagement under the carpet of the pandemic and make us forget that the vast majority of the problems were already here before COVID existed. I will not elaborate further, Mr. Speaker, as my opposition colleagues have already done a great job of detailing this reality, but I would like to reiterate the view that even though COVID has hit us hard, the bulk of our financial problems existed way before the pandemic hit us and were solely the responsibility of this government. But hey, our estimate book has many pages, so much information inside that in Planet Picardo, more pages mean more transparency. In the real world, they just mean more lies. Mr. Speaker, regarding the ongoing negotiations with the EU and the framework agreement, the disparity between the reality of Mr. Picardo and here on earth has been remarkable from the start. My party and I, despite having supported and even protected the negotiations from unfair opposition attacks, have been highlighting it from the day the framework agreement was announced. We said that the framework agreement stated quite clearly that the EU, facilitated by Spain, would have the last say regarding entry to Gibraltar. It also stated, albeit in deliberately vague language, that these EU authorities would be replaced by Spain after a four-year transition, and that there would have to be some form of tax and duty harmonization for the frontiers to be lifted. According to Politico, Mr. Speaker, one of the most reputable chroniclers of EU politics, I quote, "Just before the end of the Brexit transition period last year, Spain and the UK struck a preliminary 11th-hour deal to avoid a hard border between Gibraltar and Spain by allowing the British territory to become part of the Schengen passport-free area with the sponsorship of Madrid. All that the recently published EU mandate does, Mr. Speaker, is reiterate the positions of the framework agreement, who were clearly misinterpreted by our government, albeit in less ambiguous terms. The Commission's mandate includes Proposal 2, and I quote Politico yet again, remove physical checks and controls on persons and goods at the land border between Spain and Gibraltar while ensuring the integrity of Schengen area and the single market. The EU wants London to agree to a customs union between Gibraltar and the EU by aligning goods taxation with that of Spain, complete with, and I quote, appropriate checks and controls in Gibraltar, the mandate says. With a more honest interpretation of the framework agreement and less self-aggrandizing propaganda, this outcome should not have come as a surprise, Mr. Speaker. It was completely predictable. So much so that Spain has not maligned the mandate, as has been suggested by some, but has sent an official communique praising it, namely Official Statement 062 from the Ministerio de Exteriores, titled Spain Welcomes Proposed Draft Mandate for Negotiations on EU-UK Treaty on Gibraltar, that goes on to say, Spain is grateful for and appreciates the efforts made by the European Commission to approve a draft mandate in line with the understanding reached between Spain and the United Kingdom on the 31st of December. We said it before, and we will say it again, although I'm sure we will be ridiculed for doing so. The Chief Minister told us he had managed to close a deal that gave us all what we wanted, without any concessions. That is how things work in Planet Bigardo. The rest of us in the real world, however, know that deals only happen when all sides make concessions, and these concessions, unfortunately, always reflect the balance of power at the negotiating table. Fortunately, the European Commission's opening position will soon be brought to its knees by the Chief Minister's silky oratorial skills, as was Spain going to fall prey to Mr. Sopardi's deal-making skills when he promised to tear up the tax treaty. Fortunately, Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition has reined in his populist streak and now recognizes that the treaty is not going away and will continue to be with us even if we find ourselves in a no-deal situation. To continue with the Leader of the Opposition's speech to reiterate his ill-conceived and ill-advised narrative of wasted opportunities, which of course refers to using cross-frontier workers as bargaining chips, forgetting that the loss of these workers would have had such a bigger negative impact on Gibraltar that it would have had on Spain. This is a disingenuous argument, Mr. Speaker, that preys on some of the most base instincts of the community, and we will not let him fan the flames of xenophobia at this historic time when we need more fraternity and solidarity than ever. When he says that the tax treaty with Spain discourages inward investment, what exactly does he mean? Is he suggesting that we try to sign an agreement that continues to allow people not to pay taxes in the country they reside in? Is he suggesting that we should encourage or tolerate tax fraud? Should we want to go back to the fringes of the global economy by encouraging behaviors that are heavily frowned upon by international institutions? Is that what we should be encouraging at this time? Is that his future strategy for Gibraltar? Because that's what it sounds like, Mr. Speaker. I would also like to mention my disappointment at the fact that both Sir Joe Bolsano and Roy Clinton agree that the alternative plan after a hard Brexit should be to look south to Morocco. Let us remember, Mr. Speaker, that even though we have a large population of Gibraltarians of Moroccan descent and that trade with Morocco was key for our survival in the frontier closure years, for which we are very thankful, this is a regime that is totalitarian, oppressive, and extremely unequal. It's a bit like our relationship with Spain, Mr. Speaker. We love our neighbors, but we have serious issues with the central government. Let me remind the House that Morocco uses in its claim over the territories of Ceuta and Melilla similar arguments to the ones Spain uses to substantiate its claim over Gibraltar, much against the wishes of the people who live there. It is a grossly inadequate alternative to perhaps the largest, wealthiest, most democratic, and most egalitarian group of nations in the world. Morocco is a developing market with a population of 36 million and a GDP which is a little over half of Andalusia, one of the poorest regions in Europe. I am not saying that we should not seek out economic opportunities with Morocco and with all available markets. I am simply saying that as a replacement for access to European markets and a future plan for our post-Brexit economy, it is not. The other option, of course, tying our future even more closely to the future of Boris Johnson's Brexit Britain project, a project, Mr. Speaker, that I'm afraid does not align with Gibraltar's values of openness, diversity, and solidarity, nor does it generate great confidence throughout the electorate. I believe Mr. Picardo is right to say that our relationship with the UK, although he should really say the Johnson administration, are tighter than ever. But he forgets that this Conservative government will not last forever. What will become of this special relationship in which he has been so servile when other governments come along? What will happen when the pendulum swings away from the politics of isolation and identity back towards international collaboration and interdependence? How will his willingness to take part in so much Tory propaganda go down with his successors? One thing I can tell you for sure, Gibraltar is not ready to take any backward step in the road to nationhood and decolonization. Not for Spain, not for the UK, not for the Queen, not for anybody, Mr. Speaker. For better or worse, we are British Gibraltarians with a distinct identity, our own constitution and our own parliament. The Chief Minister now seems to suggest that a crown dependency status might be positive for Gibraltar in the future. Maybe he will care to explain in his reply what the benefits of such an arrangement might be and how this would be feasible as a matter of international law. To think that this is the alternative plan to some form of close relationship with the EU is truly disheartening, and it makes my Remainer pro-European heart weep, Mr. Speaker. And I am sure that most progressive international citizens in our community feel exactly the same way. There must be a better way, Mr. Speaker, and a good government should be able to find it. Other leaders in our very successful past rolled up their sleeves and found a way to meet the demands of our people. And even though I have little faith in this government's promises, I sincerely hope it succeeds in the enterprise of signing a treaty with Europe that brings mutual prosperity and a free-flowing border, while respecting, of course, our red lines on sovereignty. Mr. Speaker, another important issue and potential threat looming on the horizon is the pending review from the Council of Europe's anti-money laundering body, Moneyval. In Planet Picardo, this time also populated by my GSD opposition colleagues, the results were outstanding and recognition of our fabulous financial centre and our flawless laws. In response to the 2019 report conducted in Gibraltar, the Council of Experts stated that Gibraltar needs to invest more efforts in identifying, investigating, and prosecuting money laundering and in confiscation of proceeds of crime. Excuse me, Mr. Speaker. As we explained in our press statement last year, And despite the sugarcoating applied by the government and the GSD, who illustrated once again that they are not just weak in opposition, but at times shockingly ill-informed on matters of public importance, we have clear shortcomings when it comes to our anti-money laundering and combating terrorist financial controls. We fared on a par with Malta, who were found to be severely lacking. Malta were recently greylisted by Moneyval, which reflects very poorly on the country, with financial institutions around the world deeming the jurisdiction and its firms and residents to be of higher risk when providing services. This has a significant impact on jurisdictions' ability to obtain financial services, Mr. Speaker, and has a quantifiable negative impact on GDP that could be as high as 10.6%. As a financial hub reliant on access to global financial markets, we have a lot at risk. We need to be assured by government that the appropriate measures are being taken to address the shortcomings identified, and that if they are not, we need to take them urgently. We simply cannot afford to be greylisted at this stage, Mr. Speaker. The assessment made clear, however, that while our legal framework is for the most part adequate, as a nation, we have failed to execute on the measures created to counter money laundering and terrorist financing, and there has been little in the way of prosecution of such shortcomings to the degree that the report states that the effective investigation and prosecution of money laundering offences remains undemonstrated. Mr. Speaker, it is interesting to note the GSD's out of character lack of criticism at the time, perhaps born out of a wish not to highlight the weak controls applied by legal firms to aid in the prevention of money laundering. Is this another example of the GSD and the GSOP working together for the benefit of the barristocracy, Mr. Speaker? Because I can't see any other parallel. Sitting at the top of the tree, it is imperative that the legal firms set the tone for their clients and the financial sector. While our circumstances are unique, we note with caution the parallel that can be drawn between our assessment and that of Malta, which was treated nationally and globally as being of significant concern for the jurisdiction. Mr. Speaker, on the issue of community care, I was disappointed to learn how the Honourable Father of the House, Sir Joe Bossano, seems to also live in a distant planet. I feel I have to use this opportunity once again to defend my father's name, as he is not present to do it himself, unfortunately. And to that end, I'm sorry that Sir Joe has also not been present today and afforded me the same courtesy of listening to my address that I did to him. Given the Honourable Member's penchant for lengthy history lessons, and given the fact that Mr. Speaker allowed him the indulgence of doing so, let's remember that the Father of the House treated me as my father's daughter, Mr. Speaker, inelegantly, unnecessarily, and unfairly. The Honourable Minister forgets that I am a voted member of this House in my own right and in my own merit, and that my late father does not deserve to be associated with what the Honourable Minister considers to be my mistakes, on which we clearly disagree, because I always act in good faith and try to help people as best I can. But now that he's involved him, Mr. Speaker, let me also remind him that this member's father beat him every single time, and that his daughter is standing here 50 years later with her own strong mandate, with her own politics, in very different times, and would appreciate being referred to in her own capacity, unless, of course, the situation by virtue of direct and personal association calls for it, not political, Mr. Speaker. Even if it might seem impossible to believe by someone of his generation, Mr. Speaker, I do understand exactly what the problem is regarding community care. It is he who seems way too comfortable endorsing a system that requires the opaque and unaccountable management of public money. and the use of a ridiculous doublespeak when scrutinizing what is undeniably a pension policy issue and not a charity issue, Mr. Speaker, and we all know it. In the 21st century, these botched jobs are simply not good enough. We want a system that is transparent and fair, that can be discussed openly, and that provides decent standards of living to our pensioners without discrimination. The current system is none of these things. Community care has served its purpose, but is no longer fit for purpose. The time has come to address the problem of our pension system head on, so that future generations don't have to inherit this mess. Regarding our position on Community Care Officer Alliance Scheme, it is completely unfair to land us in the same place as our opposition colleagues. We have not been populist about the issue, promising the re-establishment of the scheme for all. We have not demonstrated in the street for free parking in Midtown or against osmosis. We have had a fair and prudent position laid out a day after the march that stated that we would look at the situation of those aggrieved on a case-by-case basis and offer those at risk of hardship the opportunity to take part in a scheme for a transitional period. But after this period is over, it is our opinion that it would be better to reform the entire pension system than to continue tweaking the current mess we're in, Mr. Speaker. We believe this would be better for future generations, for international relations, and for the welfare of our pensioners. Mr. Speaker, as for the measures included in this budget that are aimed at boosting government revenue, we agree with Action for Poverty that the words of the Chief Minister in Tuesday's speech are lacking in empathy for those in need. It was a very confrontational speech, fighting windmills and making up imaginary villains and foes that he is going to single-handedly and heroically put in their place. Of course, he was always referring to those entitled Gibraltarians who dispute his narrative or those who require the assistance of our wholly inadequate welfare system. This is what is popularly referred to kissing up and kicking down, the opposite of what a socialist government should aspire to do. The fiscal measures implemented are tougher on the working and middle classes than on those who could really make a difference in helping to fund the post-COVID recovery. In its Journal of Economic Studies, in a study named Tackling Income Inequality, the Role of Taxes and Transfers, the OECD states that, and I quote, personal income tax is the most progressive tax, although there are significant cross-country variations. Social security contributions, consumption taxes, and real estate taxes tend to be regressive in most countries. Despite this, very little has been done to really implement fair, progressive tax raises. In the area of personal income taxes, there have been no changes to the tax rate bands under either the allowance-based system or gross income-based system, even though those on the gross income-based system continue to pay 18% for income over 500K and below 700K, and 5% on all income over and above this figure. 5%, Mr. Speaker, a regressive tax system that allows the super rich to get out of paying their fair share of the resources our community so desperately needs. Category 2 individuals have seen an increase in minimum tax payable from £22,000 to £32,000 per annum, while the tax cap for income taxed under the certificate has been increased from £27,560 to £37,310. There is only one way to describe these measures, Mr. Speaker. Peanuts. HEPS individuals, which stands for High Executive Possessing Specialist Skills, despite being some of our highest paid professionals, will continue to pay the same rate of taxation, with the only difference that to qualify, they will have to be paid 40K funds or more. So the richer the HEPS you are, the less taxes you pay. This is undoubtedly absurd. It defeats the purpose of having such a measure, as we will have less HEPS in Gibraltar who will bring in valuable skills and assets and will therefore end up raising little revenue, if any at all. What happened with the plain old raising taxes for the rich, Mr. Speaker? Is that not a socialist mantra anymore? Can't we just tell all the extremely highly paid members of our community that they have to pay in accordance to their means, if only while we get our economy back on track? Mr. Picardo's new catchphrase that what matters is, and I quote from his speech, what we offer to people who have the least, not what we demand from the people who have the most, has to be the most nonsensical and anti-socialist mantra I have ever heard. Who is buying this nonsense, Mr. Speaker? Are the good old honest socialists in his party listening to this trite? Instead, what we do is we raise electricity bills by a huge and sudden 16%, which will be a massive blow to some of our most vulnerable. We raise contributions to social insurance, which will, despite what Mr. Vossano, Sir Joe Vossano, will lead you to believe, always impact more on those who have the least. Even though social insurance contributions are somewhat adjusted to earnings, they have caps that make it so that they will always amount to a higher percentage of earnings for low earners than for high ones. And there is only one word to describe that, Mr. Speaker. Regressive. It is regressive. We understand the need to raise corporate tax slightly. At the end of the day, this is tax based on profits, not on income. And we welcome the fiscal stimuli for employment that go along with it. We are concerned, however, that without a proper government strategy, let's remember that government is by a lot the biggest employer and investor in Gibraltar, our economy will never fully modernize. We will find ourselves, much like the other developed economies, transitioning to a more unequal model in which new technology is harnessed and exploited by the already privileged few, thus increasing the inequality problem. Alas, there is no economic modernization strategy in the horizon, only, as the Honorable Roy Clinton put it, begging, borrowing, and scraping. Mr. Speaker, on the matter of births, we don't agree in the slightest with this new policy of selling the small births marina urgently and the small births in the birth marina urgently and allowing them to be freely transferable once sold. Could the Chief Minister please explain to us in his reply, after the mess created by subsidized affordable homes entering the private real estate market at extortionate prices, why the government would introduce a new, distorted, and unfair government-subsidized market? And what about the price, Mr. Speaker? The Chief Minister stated that the return is close to the price of development. So what kind of a business venture is this? If we sell boat marinas at less than cost price, what kind of value are we giving the taxpayer? This policy is just absurd. If the berths are a socialized enterprise, then they should be rented and available to all Gibraltarians. If they are for a profit venture, then they should make a significant profit, as all real estate that is sold in Gibraltar always has significantly more demand than supply. This is just a way to make a quick buck, Mr. Speaker. It will create government-subsidized social inequality, frustrate people, continue to distort our real estate markets, and squander yet another valuable asset that belongs to all of us. Another important chapter that did not feature in the chronicles of Mr. Picardo is the state of complete disarray of the GHA. Waiting lists are enormous, appointments almost impossible to access, phone lines saturated, professionals overworked, management is all over the place, corners are being cut left, right, and centre. Mental health services continue to be inadequate and overrun, and in the meantime, people are getting more frustrated, sicker, and more worried. The lacklustre provision of our healthcare that never had the opportunity to really recover from the COVID pandemonium has become another serious health hazard for the people of Gibraltar. Behind these seemingly anodyne numbers and statistics, Mr. Speaker, there are people suffering and lives deteriorating. We posted a few testimonies of people who experienced this a few months back, and despite the promises made, things seem to be getting worse, not better. Also, let's not forget that the National Dementia Strategy that was hailed just before the last election with huge fanfare has not yet been implemented, despite the growing nature of the problem and more people with dementia living alone, vulnerable and undiagnosed. And Mr. Speaker, perhaps one thing we can all agree on in this House is the severity in the lack of mental health support services. And although government paints these services as rosy and robust, Mr. Speaker, I assure you the reality on the ground is anything but. I have often appealed to members opposite on the pressing need for a cohesive start-to-functional approach for mental health sufferers. Whatever they are doing right now, it is simply not working, Mr. Speaker. Those who know me will know that the lion's share of my time as an MP is spent working with very fragile mental health sufferers who have no structure, support, or pathway to a long-term care plan that will deliver long-lasting results. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, this leaves untrained and unsupported people like myself in this field trying to help those desperate on the brink, something I consider both dangerous and irresponsible, Mr. Speaker. I can't stress enough how much of a priority a long-term mental health policy is for our community, and I urge the government to take immediate action on this now. We eagerly await the policies due to be implemented next month, and we hope they adequately address the recommendations of the report from Public Health England, a report, by the way, that was hidden from the public for over a year and still remained relevant when published. Mr. Speaker, on equality, it is all well and good for government to congratulate itself for its record on equality, and although some of it is deserved, much of it is not. For example, Mr. Speaker, despite the surrogacy legislation being passed as far back as January, same-sex couples wishing to retrospectively be listed as parents of children born before the legislation was enacted are still struggling to access this right. A little equality is not equality, Mr. Speaker. So please, I urge the Justice and Equality Ministry to finalise the implementation of this law already so that same-sex parents stop getting turned away at the civil status office when seeking legal recognition of their parenthood. I would also like to raise the lack of gender balance in our public boards, which are perennially male-dominated. I want to ask the government, what is so hard about finding equal numbers of women to appoint to boards? Are we less capable? Are we less considered? I cannot understand, Mr. Speaker. We often see pictures of public boards filled with men in suits when our women deserve at least an equal share of the representation in those platforms. We are 50% of the population, Mr. Speaker. A little equality is not equality, Mr. Speaker. And when will we see a truly egalitarian paternity leave plans for parents so that society can truly move forward equally and with the same opportunities, Mr. Speaker? When will those residents of the Queen's substandard, filthy hostel be treated as equal citizens and relocated to premises worthy of the country with the highest GDP per capita in the world? Immediately, Mr. Speaker, should be the answer to this pressing issue, as well as the others. Immediately. Mr. Speaker, menopause is something that not many will go through in this House. But outside of this House, women in the workplace are encountering challenges managing menopause while they are at work. Mr. Speaker, I propose to move a motion at the next available opportunity in Parliament aimed at increasing awareness and support for women in menopause in the workplace, and after consultation with the Chief Minister, he has agreed to support a motion of this nature. I have also discussed it with the Leader of the Opposition, who has indicated his support for the motion as well, and I look forward to presenting it in due course. Mr. Speaker, on the Crimes Amendment Act and the referendum, I was proud to work with two other party leaders in this House, the Honourable Chief Minister and the Deputy Chief Minister, to send a message to the women of Gibraltar that we stood by their rights to bodily autonomy. We collaborated to project the important message that women deserve healthcare in our own jurisdiction, and I am glad that the result has meant that the days of judgment and prosecution and persecution are finally over. I have to say, I did find it disappointing to note that the Ministry of Equality was nowhere to be found in this campaign, given that reproductive rights are part and parcel of equality rights in any democracy worthy of its name. Mr. Speaker, I also welcome the rise in disability benefits as announced by the Chief Minister and remind him that these individuals should always be at the forefront of our economic planning, because we are duty-bound to help make the lives of those living with disabilities as easy as humanly possible. This is why, Mr. Speaker, I continue to campaign for a change in government policy on its decision to not renew cross-border key worker posts in favour of untrained, often unqualified, local workers. After liaising with parents of special needs individuals directly affected who have been working with these carers for many months and some years and forged bonds, trust and friendship, it was clear to me that this was an erroneous and cruel policy. It was also cruel, Mr. Speaker, when government accused me of exploiting these individuals. May I remind this House, Mr. Speaker, that much to the dismay of the members opposite, we are not a one-party state. On this side of the House, we are all paid members of Her Majesty's opposition, and as such, it is our duty to carry out our role of holding this government to account with diligence and commitment. And this means listening and representing the constituents who come to us seeking support. And I will continue doing this always, regardless of whoever wrote that press statement with its manipulative retorts. So I urge the members opposite, as a very minimum, to respect our role as opposition, and even embrace it. Mr. Speaker, the issue of environment doesn't seem to be much of a problem on planet Bigardo, even though it is potentially much more harmful than the COVID pandemic and is waiting for us just around the corner. The tragic climate phenomena we have seen in recent months with record-breaking heat waves and deadly floods should yet be another wake-up call, reminding us that regardless of our economic situation, the fight against climate change cannot wait. In the meantime, we continue with our completely cosmetic Green Gibraltar farce, something that will not change judging by the measures implemented in this budget. The fact, for example, that there have been no applications for deductions on improvement of EPC ratings is telling of a failed policy, much like the rest of this government's green agenda. The Chief Minister says that the government are leading by example by buying electric cars. However, where was his example when import duties for all cars was dropped to zero last year, Mr. Speaker, while the entire world is heavily incentivizing the purchase of electric vehicles? We dropped duties for all cars, including huge diesel-guzzling SUVs. And we're expected and we're told that it's because people will dispose of their other older cars, which we all know are still circulating in the second or third-hand market. Mr. Speaker, this was a very much a wasted opportunity and a direct attack on the environment. And let's not forget, Mr. Speaker, that after 10 years of GSOP Liberal lip service to the environment, we are still pumping out raw sewage into the sea. Let me say that again, Mr. Speaker. We are pumping out raw sewage into the sea. 10 years after the production of a sewage treatment plant that was promised in the 2011 GSOP Liberal Manifesto and then mysteriously disappeared from the 2015 Manifesto. So to sum up, more cars on our roads than ever, raw sewage failed promises, and the only thing green about this government's policies is that they would make Dr. Seuss's character, the Onceler, green with envy. One item of good news, Mr. Speaker, in this budget is the announcement of the imminent publication of a bill for an act to make provision for the regulation of medical cannabis and connected purposes. All I can think to say is, imagine how many people we would have been able to help if they had taken my proposal seriously, Mr. Speaker, when I brought it to this House over 4 years ago. The amount of pain we could have spared some of our most sick and vulnerable. But of course, Mr. Speaker, we weren't so desperate for cash back then. Back then, Mr. Cortes was adamant that no legislative change could happen without a pronouncement of the Drugs Advisory Council and more clear clinical medical evidence. Maybe the Chief Minister, in his reply, will care to explain to us what has changed, other than the prospect of a lucrative business that is already attracting the attention of big money and big firms in our community. And special mention must be given to the e-government scandal, Mr. Speaker, that both my party and the GGCA have highlighted on several occasions. A case that clearly illustrates the problem of accountability that we suffer in our democracy. Close to £14 million, Mr. Speaker, £14 million is the bill the taxpayer has footed so far for an e-government platform that is in absolute shambles. Apart from the ETB, which is a fully integrated back office service, the rest is nothing more than a list of glorified emails that have to then be processed manually by civil servants as they would in a counter. All this while counters are closed. The lack of value for money provided for this investment is abysmal, Mr. Speaker. Also, the way in which contracts have been adjudicated is unorthodox, to say the very least. When questioned on the cost of this disastrous service, the Honourable Minister Isola provided a reply that conflated real e-service expenses with other recurring IT and LD expenses as a smokescreen to evade proper scrutiny and was called out for it by the GGCA in a recent press release. His reply? Silence. No acknowledgement whatsoever. Tumbleweeds, Mr. Speaker, tumbleweeds. And then Together Gibraltar called it out. His answer this time? Can you guess? You just don't understand. No answers, no admission of responsibility, no shame, Mr. Speaker, no shame at all. £14 million. Mr. Speaker, I call this budget the budget of decay for a simple reason. As we all know, parties in Gibraltar do not win elections, they lose them. And they do so always too late, after exhaustingly long mandates, overstaying their welcome, trying to subvert democratic rules, and finally decomposing in front of the very eyes of the electorate. This was true of the last GSLP administration, true of the last GSD administration, and will be true of this administration. And the rot has already begun, Mr. Speaker. It was always clear to me that the moment the money tree wilted, the cracks would begin to show. But the COVID pandemic has accelerated a process that already started, albeit subtly, around the time of the last election. Cronyism had already started to get out of control. Contracts were going through to the usual suspects. Freedom of speech was starting to suffer. The civil service was beginning to show signs of disarray. The Chief Minister's petulance was turning slowly into disregard and disrespect of the electorate. It is clear that this GSOP will not go down without a fight either. And now we know what this fight looks like. Lies, lies, and more lies, spin, spin, and more spin. The GSOP will rather decompose in plain sight than accept any responsibility and attempt to mend its ways. It is like the scorpion in the fable of the scorpion and the frog, Mr. Speaker. True to its nature, it cannot but sting the frog that carries it to the other side of the river, even if it means drowning them both. Where is the anti-corruption authority promised in the last manifesto and other manifestos before it? What has this liberation movement without equal in our history done to make our institutions more accountable and more democratic? Nothing, Mr. Speaker. A big, fat zero. As for the excuses, they have two firm favourites. You don't understand, which is usually directed at Together Gibraltar, and you did it worse, which is usually directed at the GSD. The former is as sexist as it is laughable, and the latter, we've already had a decade of you did it worse, and the argument is still going strong. The option for the electorate is clear. If you do not want another 12 years of the same finger-pointing, we need to bring about real change at the next election. We disagree on the Leader of the Opposition's diagnosis on why this community has succeeded in the past. Our democracy is far from being vibrant. It might be vibrant on our streets and on our cafes, but it is not vibrant inside these four walls, Mr. Speaker. Our lack of transparency and accountability and our lack of proper democratic checks and balances make our democracy a very flawed one in desperate need of reform. As for voting for or against the budget, it makes little difference, Mr. Speaker. With the inbuilt majority that the government has, it will continue to break the rules and cheat regardless. Civil servants will get paid regardless, at least until long the money runs out. Opposition will complain about our democratic deficits regardless and get nowhere regardless. Until one day, a new party comes in, a young, fearless party with no baggage, willing to take on the big challenges of our time. It is for this reason that I will abstain from voting on this budget this year. We will simply not take part in this ridiculous farce until we can change the reasons that make it so farcical. And the Chief Minister will no doubt accuse me in his reply of not being consistent with previous positions, Mr. Speaker, that I've had in other years. But, Mr. Speaker, in light of what is unfolding before our very eyes, the inconsistency would be voting for the appropriation bill. Mr. Speaker, the age of entitlement is well and truly over. But what has a decade of GSOP government done to prepare us for this? Will we be able to get out there and compete in the big, wide world if some of the privileges we are used to are taken away? Have we fostered the opposite of the culture of entitlement? Are we still as strong, resolute, and resilient as we were? We will be able to see through the lies and the spin and land back on planet Earth, ready to stand on our own 2 feet, will we be? Or do we want to continue living on planet Picardo until it is too late? This is the budget of decay because I believe it marks the beginning of the end. And so do more and more of our fellow Gibraltarians. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Gilbert Nkuthi.
Mr. Speaker. It is, of course, disappointing to hear what has been clearly and unashamedly a popular speech by the Honourable Lady.
Yeah, yeah.
We all know what populism is leading to in other countries, and I'm sure that the Chief Minister will reply in full to what the Honourable Lady has said. She has ended by saying, this is the end. She hasn't said the end of what. Let us hope she's only referring to this side of the House and not anything wider. Otherwise, we would be in, especially with the Honourable Lady all the others in government for a very, very hard time indeed. Populism takes us nowhere. It takes us to places that Gibraltar doesn't want to go.
Yeah.
And that is not what this government has been about. It's certainly not what this government was about when I was in government, and certainly from where I sit now, certainly not what I see now this government is doing. Mr. Speaker, my honourable colleagues in on this side of the House, in particular Mr. Cortes, Mr. Tarianani, my friend, the Honourable Ms. Sacramento, and Sir Joe, have dealt with those areas which were part of my responsibilities when I was a government minister, when the pandemic hit us in March 2020. And I will not say any more than what they have said on those areas. But I do want to express my own appreciation to all the heads of department and the other public servants who worked with me in those very difficult times, particularly the very early days, and who managed to adapt and change the way we provided a service to the public, to school children, to pensioners, to users of the port and the airport. And I owe them all a huge debt of gratitude for their assistance, their support, and their dedication to duty. And we've heard this week that the two of the heads that worked with me during that time, Nikki Guerrero and Jackie Mason, are retiring or have retired. And I wish them both a very long, fruitful and happy retirement. And I also take this opportunity to wish Mr. Martinez, the clerk of this House, who will not be with us after September of this year, also a long and happy retirement. But, Mr. Speaker, the enormous effort which was put in by public servants was not just evident in the departments, clearly, that I was responsible for. We saw it across the government. It has certainly not been easy during the last year to deliver the public services that we have all been accustomed to. Lockdown and restrictions have necessarily meant that things have had to be done differently. It was not possible for us to simply pop down to a public counter to get information, to make or receive a payment, to make an application. Suddenly, none of this could be done. And it was not a case of a planned close down and a gradual shift to remote or online services. It happened almost overnight. There was a need to adapt. There was a need to devise new ways of delivering public services. And it was not without difficulty. It was not without hiccups. But again, it involved a tremendous effort by all of those public servants who sought to ensure that services continue to be provided even in those circumstances. And it is important to recognize and to congratulate all of those involved in the delivery of public services. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister has said that this is not a giveaway budget. None of us could have expected any differently this year. The Chief Minister described this as a prudent budget, a rebuilding budget, a budget to promote ambition and entrepreneurship. It was also described as a budget for young people, protecting scholarships, protecting the affordable housing schemes, protecting the programmes for new schools, and all of this is to be welcomed. It cannot have been easy, Mr. Speaker, to arrive at the right balance between prudence, rebuilding, making sure that ambition is not lost, and protecting those areas which are crucial, critical importance to our youth. This budget does precisely that, Mr. Speaker, and I must therefore congratulate the government and the Chief Minister in particular for a budget that seeks to navigate these treacherous waters carefully, but also with determination and steadfastness. It is, of course, a budget that must be looked at in its proper context. Indeed, all of the speeches by honourable members during this week have been marked in some way by the COVID pandemic, or by references to the COVID pandemic, because this has touched each and every one of us in some way. We have all been subject to a lockdown, significant restrictions on what we could do or what we could not do. Some have caught the virus, others have been subject to self-isolation, but all of us have been affected. We have not been able to see and be with loved ones. We have not been able to visit our sick or elderly relatives as we would normally do. We have not been able to travel when we want to. Nothing is the same as it used to be, and that is likely to be the way of things to come. It is clear that despite the protection afforded by the vaccine, that we are going to have to learn to live with the COVID being part of our community and of our lives for a significant period. And there will be times, Mr. Speaker, when things appear to be almost totally normal. Other times, as we are experiencing now, numbers will again start to rise, and it will be a stark reminder that the normality we used to know has gone and that things are different now. Mr. Speaker, we have heard in the various speeches this week many words of tribute to those who have been in the front line, our health and care workers in particular, and have borne the brunt of the pressure which COVID has brought. And all of those words cannot properly express the deep gratitude that we must all feel to those who unexpectedly were called upon to go well beyond their normal duties and who rose to the challenge in an effort to keep us well and as safe as possible. But they are not the only ones to whom we must be grateful. In one of my daily briefings last year during lockdown, whilst I was still in government, Mr. Speaker, I recalled the appearance at a symposium in 1976 of a World War II pilot. And he recounted how buildings, factories and buildings and factories were devastated during the war, the Second World War. And yet there was a sense of coming together in a united effort which was strengthened at a time of crisis. He spoke of the many sacrifices which were made and of the unsung heroes who worked tirelessly, including those making aircraft parts, and which allowed him and his colleagues to win the battle for the skies of Britain. And he concluded by saying, that is what mattered. It was a united effort by everybody. And so it has been, Mr. Speaker, in Gibraltar. We must therefore be grateful to everyone in our community. It was and continues to be a collective effort. And as I said at that time, we have to salute all those heroes in Gibraltar, frontline staff, back office workers, volunteers, and even those who stayed at home when they had to. Every one of us has had a role to play and still have a role to play, whether by being directly involved or by complying with the rules. The whole community has had to make some sort of sacrifice. But, Mr. Speaker, despite all the tremendous effort by everyone, it has not been possible to keep all members of our community safe and well. Some have been more affected than others. Some have had to be admitted to hospital. Some have had to be cared for in the intensive care unit. And sadly, some have succumbed to the virus. We must therefore, and it has been mentioned a few times this week, but we must remember the 94 individuals who have sadly died with or from COVID and the sadness that this has brought to their families and friends. And Gibraltar being such a small place, it is inevitable, Mr. Speaker, that this has affected someone we know. This pandemic is not something that we hear about in the news or is a disease that is happening in faraway land, which we can think the distance itself can protect us. It has hit our community in the same way that it has affected and is affecting every single corner of the globe. That is, of course, no consolation to us. But what it does mean, Mr. Speaker, is that there is a collective effort, a global effort, with countries, scientists and others coming together in a fight the like of which many of us have never seen in our lifetimes. And I therefore also pay tribute, Mr. Speaker, to the science community. They are not always in the visible front line, but they are very much at the heart of our battle against COVID. We have seen advances in scientific research that no one thought possible. In particular, we have seen the development of various vaccines in an unusually short time. These have brought hope. We always thought, and now we know for certain, that the vaccines would not eliminate COVID overnight. But we have seen the positive effect that these vaccines have brought, at the very least by reducing the severity of symptoms and the risk of hospitalization or death. And we must therefore commend the government for having made early arrangements with the UK for the supply of vaccines, resulting in a vaccination program which virtually no other country has been able to replicate, and which has already seen a large percentage of our population and workers receiving two doses of the vaccine. And this, Mr. Speaker, has not happened by accident. And it was not just a question of securing the supply of the vaccines. It also required a full-scale logistical effort, which was nothing short of world-class. We have all seen it in practice. The arrangements have, to a large extent, worked seamlessly, and we must therefore be thankful and congratulate all of those involved in organizing and delivering the vaccination program. I have no doubt that they have contributed significantly to ensure that the worst effects of COVID are reduced and will also contribute to saving lives, and nothing could be more important than that. And all of that, Mr. Speaker, must be seen in conjunction with the enormous effort made with the testing program. The figures on testing given earlier this week by my friend, the Honourable Samantha Sacramento, are truly impressive. As with the vaccination program, the numbers suggest that we have been world leaders in this area. Again, it has required a great deal of planning, of organizing and delivering, all of which has been seamless and effective. This has gone hand in hand with our contract tracing team and those involved in checking how those who have tested positive are feeling or evolving. And a big thank you and well done to all of them. Mr. Speaker, unlike the opposition, the GSD opposition, I welcome the announcement by the Chief Minister this week of the entire funding of the Midtown Park by trusted Novus Bank. It is a beautiful park, which is already being used and enjoyed by many members of our community. And the funding shows the commitment of the new owners of the bank to Gibraltar. I also welcome the announcement of the Deputy Chief Minister of the generous donations by the Parasol Foundation for the refurbishment of Parliament and of the Mount. We have had other donations for public projects in the past. For example, the Kusuma Trust funded an extension to St. Martin's School during our first term in office. And all of these are examples of people who come from abroad to invest in Gibraltar, but also give back to Gibraltar. And we have to recognize that. So like Trusted Novus Bank, the Parasol Foundation and Kusuma Trust, we have other benefactors in our community, including the Awani Trust and many others, and all deserve to be thanked, and I do so here today. That is why, Mr. Speaker, it was truly shocking to hear Mr. Clinton mock the donations which were announced in the manner that he did. Shame, he said. Doesn't look right. If we cannot afford it, then we shouldn't do it. So the Honourable Member, who criticises the government for spending on capital projects, prefers that we should not have a park in the centre of town, that we should not have a parliament refurbished, that we should not have the Mount refurbished, because that is precisely what the Honourable Member is saying with his irresponsible comments. And what I say, Mr. Speaker, is congratulations to the government for having been able to attract these donations, and a huge thank you to those who are prepared to give for the public good. Mr. Speaker, the comments by the Honourable Member are not only misplaced and irresponsible, they are also damaging to Gibraltar. The Honourable Member seems intent in discouraging benefactors from coming forward and doing good for the community. Exactly. Not for the government, but for the community.
Exactly.
Who does the Honourable Member think benefits from a donation for the creation of a park? It is the community, not the government. Who does the Honourable Member think benefits from a donation for the refurbishment of the Mount? It is the community, Mr. Speaker, not the government. Who does the Honourable Member think benefits from a refurbishment of Parliament? It is the community and members of Parliament, including him, as members of the community, not the government. So let the community know, Mr. Speaker, let people outside this House know that the GSD opposition opposes benefits to our community, opposes charitable donations, opposes benefactors acting for the public good. The opposition should be welcoming philanthropy, not knocking it down. And of course, the reality is obvious, Mr. Speaker. Anything goes when it comes to criticise the government, even acting contrary to the interests of the community. And that is exactly what Mr. Clinton has done. Mr. Clinton also criticised the arrangement for the building of the new St. Martin's School. So the Honourable Member, who also criticises borrowing for capital projects And when the government arranges for a new school to be built at no capital cost to the government, he also criticizes that.
Yeah.
So what is it? Does the honorable member also wish that there should not be a new St. Mary's school? If government borrows to fund this, he criticizes it. If government arranges with a private entity for them to fund it, he also criticizes it. Is his position the same as with Parliament, the Mount and the Park? If we can't afford it, we shouldn't do it. So let parents of young children know that the GSD prefers that there should not be a new St. Mary's school, and let them be judged on that. Mr. Speaker, we learned this week of the sad passing of former Minister Brian Perez. And we heard various tributes to Mr. Perez, and I would add my own condolences to his wife and his family. We also heard that Mr. Perez headed important ministries. At a time of a closed frontier, time of great difficulties, and when money was tight. And I could not help reflecting once again that Gibraltar has faced difficult times before, and as we often say, we always come out stronger. So it is not a time to despair. It is a time, it continues to be a time, as I have said before, of hope. And Mr. Speaker, contrary, and despite everything that the opposition, all of the members of the opposition have said, the economic indicators do give us hope. And it is true, as the Chief Minister has indicated, that the forecast GDP for 2020-21 is 2.44 billion, a forecast contraction of 4.9%. Much as we all regret any contraction in GDP, it again has to be looked at in its context. It is a contraction from a position of consistent growth over many years. GDP has grown in 10 years by 133%, an average of 13.3% a year. That is what is described by the leader of the opposition in his budget contribution as economic mismanagement. Economic growth at an average of 13.3% a year over many years is considered economic mismanagement by the opposition. Mr. Speaker, let us imagine a member of parliament in another country, in Spain, in France, in England, in Germany, describing economic growth in that country of 13.3% a year for 10 years as economic mismanagement. They would be laughed out. They would be laughed out of the chamber. Mr. Speaker, they would be laughed out of the chamber. GDP per capita, Mr. Speaker. GDP per capita has grown for 2019-20 for to £79,707. Placing Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, GDP per capita has grown for 2019-2020 to £79,707, placing Gibraltar in first position in the world. That is considered economic mismanagement by the opposition. Also described as nonsense by Mr. Clinton and meaningless by the Honourable Lady today. Well, what we should be, Mr. Speaker, is proud of our achievement as a nation, because that is what we have achieved as a nation. And what we should not be doing is seeking to denigrate that, because these indicators are testament not just to the efforts of the government, but also to the private sector. It is not just the government that drives the economy, but it is the private sector as well. They are important drivers in our economy. So the efforts of the private sector have contributed significantly to the economic growth and also to an increase of GDP per capita. And those are the efforts that are described by honourable members opposite as nonsense and meaningless. And government revenue, Mr. Speaker, has also increased substantially over this time. That is considered economic mismanagement by the opposition. And the reality, Mr. Speaker, is that the words of the leader of the opposition, Mr. Clinton, ring very hollow. The reality is that GDP growth over many years and growth in government revenues has put Gibraltar in a solid economic position in which to face difficulties, including this pandemic. And indeed, it is precisely because of the management of the economy which we have had, that Gibraltar has been in a position to meet the financial challenge which the pandemic has brought. And it is because of that, Mr. Speaker, that our recovery will be less painful than it is being and will be for other countries. It will still require a cautious approach to our finances, a prudent approach, and that is what we have with this budget. We have also heard that average earnings of £32,000, we have average earnings of £32,625.26, an increase of 26% since this government has been in office. And we have 95% reduction in unemployment since the election of this government in 2011. Is that also meaningless? It is, in fact, Mr. Speaker, a remarkable achievement, because these are not just figures. These are not just statistics. These are not just a reflection of the state of our economy. These are matters that affect people directly. These are matters that affect the quality of lives of members of our community. More people in employment and higher average gross earnings means more income to our households. And all of that is to be welcomed. And it is truly a shame and a sad reflection of the type of politics of members opposite that they don't recognise that. Mr. Speaker, this budget is about approving an appropriation bill so that funds are available to meet government expenses. In this context, it is difficult to understand the position of the official opposition in opposing the bill, and we have heard today from the Honourable Lady who will be abstaining, but the official opposition, the GSD, have said that they will be opposing this bill. And it is difficult to understand that in ordinary times, but where we have faced and are still facing a pandemic, the opposition's stance is quite simply incomprehensible. And as the Chief Minister has said, the debate on the second reading is about the general principles on the bill. That is what we are voting on now. Is the opposition not in favour of the general principle that funds have to be available to meet government expenses? Is the opposition not in favour of the general principle that funds are required for the GHA or for pensions? Where do the honourable members think that money will come from, if not from an appropriation bill? In fact, by law, it can only come from an appropriation bill. So what is the opposition saying in opposing this bill? That the Accountant General should act illegally by paying out money that has not been appropriated? Is that what they're saying? Because that is the only conclusion that one can reach from the opposition's stance. A stance which is not just incomprehensible, it is also irresponsible, Mr. Speaker. And it is, in any event, worth looking at some of the provisions of the bill itself, the bill that we are debating today on the general principles, to see what it is that the opposition are opposing. Mr. Speaker, clause 2.1 of the bill says, the Accountant General may, under the authority of a general warrant issued in accordance with the Public Finance Control and Audit Act, pay out of the Consolidated Fund of Gibraltar for the year ending 31st March 2022 a sum not exceeding £550,742,000. And that is for the purposes set out in Part 1 of the Schedule to the bill. That the Accountant General should have access to money to pay out up to £550 million for the purposes set out in Part 1. How can they oppose that, Mr. Speaker, as a general principle? Because this includes £26 million to the Treasury, which no doubt will pay for many salaries. How are they opposed to that as a general principle? It includes, Mr. Speaker, Part 1. It includes, Mr. Speaker, £58 million for education. And that is expenditure that is required for books, for materials, for school children, for scholarships. And they are opposed to that as a general principle. It includes £17 million, Mr. Speaker, for policing, necessary to keep us all safe, including themselves and their families. And they oppose that as a general principle. Mr. Speaker, clause 6 of the bill will authorise if passed, the Accountant General to pay out $285,386,000 for public utilities. Again, how can they oppose that as a general principle? It includes $140 million for the GHA. Necessary, Mr. Speaker, absolutely necessary to pay nurses, to pay doctors, to pay equipment, to pay life-saving equipment and medicines, and to pay for sponsored patients. They, members opposite, and their families will benefit from that. But yet, they oppose that as a general principle. The $285 million, Mr. Speaker, for general utilities also includes sums for elderly residential services and the care agency, necessary to look after our elderly and vulnerable children and vulnerable adults. And the GSD oppose that as a general principle. It sounds incredible, Mr. Speaker, but sadly, it is true. Mr. Speaker, despite the difficult economic circumstances this year, the Chief Minister has been able to announce an increase in disability benefit, an increase in the disability tax allowance, an increase in old age pension, an increase in the minimum wage, and at the same time, no increase in personal taxation. And all of these things are part of a budget that the Leader of the Opposition describes as bad for ordinary people. And what it is, Mr. Speaker, is a budget that shows the commitment of this government to the vulnerable, to the elderly, and to all of our workers. It is a commitment which has been present with this government since it was elected in 2011. And it is a commitment on which this government has not wavered. It is a commitment on which this government has delivered and deserves to be congratulated. So unlike members opposite, Mr. Speaker, I will unreservedly support this appropriation bill and make absolutely sure that the Accountant General has money available to him to continue to pay salaries, to pay the GHA, to pay pensions, to pay for the upkeep of schools, to pay for scholarships, to pay for policing, and every other thing that this bill will authorise the Accountant General to pay. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, before I ask you to call upon me to reply, I propose that honourable members should have the weekend to reflect on how they've indicated that they're going to vote. And then, Mr. Speaker, on Monday at 10:30, I propose that we should come back so that people can understand at prime time, Mr. Speaker, because I have a lot of important things to say in response to some of the nonsense that has been uttered and which cannot be allowed to remain unchallenged on the record, because our public, Mr. Speaker, do not deserve to think that the things that the honourable members are saying are true, and for that reason I will come back at prime time to tell people, Mr. Speaker, why what they've heard today and the past few days is really just the reality on the Planet of the Apes and Planet Hollywood.
I now propose a question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Monday the 26th of July at 10:30 a.m. I now put the question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Monday the 26th of July at 10:30 a.m. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Pass. This House will now adjourn to Monday the 26th of July at 10:30 a.m.